This is the Senate Committee on Health and Human Services. The date is March 9th, 2007. The time, 11 a.m. Location, Lebanon, Oregon. Committee Chair is Senator Bill Morissette.
Devin, and thank you for being here. Mayor Toombs, welcome. Did you want to say anything?
I'd like to welcome you.
You want to say it into the microphone so we have a living record of it? And anything you said may be held against you, so.
Just like a council meeting?
Yeah, right. City council meeting.
I'd like to welcome the senators to Lebanon. I'm pleased that you came to Lebanon rather than Sweet Home, which was your last.
For the record, we were in Sweet Home last session.
Yes. This is fine. And I don't know whether to thank you or congratulate you for coming to Lebanon, or maybe you should thank us for allowing you to get out of the zoo. But thanks for coming for Lebanon, coming to Lebanon. And there's a couple of things I would like to.
I'm sorry. Go ahead and identify yourself for the.
I'm Ken Toombs, Mayor of Lebanon, and again, welcome to Lebanon. And one thing I'd like to appraise you of, that the Lebanon Hospital was awarded the Business of the Year by the Chamber of Commerce this past year, so that's a real plus for the hospital. And again, thanks for coming to Lebanon, and we'll turn the hearing over to you, Bill.
Okay. Thank you very much. And the healing garden is beautiful, and that goes along the hospital. It's quite large, so it's very nice. Thank you. Okay. We're going to have an informational hearing this morning, and we will hear a bill, Senate Bill 648, after lunch. It will be a public hearing. We have a possible work session, but that was just to make sure that DHS was here. Are they here? They will be.
Bill, you're not supposed to let the secrets out like that.
It's not a secret. Rick, Dr. Rick Wolfat, would you come up, please?
Thank you, Chairman Morissette, Vice Chairman Cruz. For the record, I'm Rick Wolpat. I'm a family physician. I've lived practice here in Lebanon for 28 years. And Tuesday night this week, actually, I was working in a free clinic that here in Lebanon, that we, the East Lynn Community Clinic, and I volunteer my services there to see patients who are without insurance and less fortunate. And I saw a gentleman by the name of, who I'll call Jim, who's a 24-year-old insulin-dependent diabetic. And I said, when was the last time he'd seen a physician? And he said, about 6 months ago when I was hospitalized in diabetic ketoacidosis because I ran out of insulin. And at that point, you know, I started to realize and have always realized the importance of our clinic to supporting those patients. I did some checking and found out that the hospitalization was somewhere between $9,000 and $10,000 for 2 nights in the hospital, which was written off by the hospital as charity care, since Jim currently lives in a tent. Subsequently, we've been providing him with insulin and current medications and so on and so forth. And the point of the story is simple from my perspective, and that is that in communities like Lebanon and Sweet Home and Brownsville, the hospital and the providers in the community are the safety net. And we're here to take care of everybody regardless of their ability to pay. And if we don't take care of them in East Lynn Clinic or in our own clinics, we'll take care of them in our emergency rooms and in our hospitals. We here have been fortunate to have some visionary leadership, and that's been on the part of the hospital and community boards that run our hospital. And that visionary leadership in the 1980s saw ahead to bring together the physicians and hospitals and the hospital to work together. And then in the 90s, that group again came together with the regional hospitals, both those in Albany and Corvallis, to form Samaritan Health Services. And the vision behind that was that physicians and hospitals working together rather than competing can provide health care to their communities and can do a better job. I'd like to leave you with three take-home points. First off, our hospitals and physicians are the safety net for both physical and mental health. We have support through our county health departments, but we are the place of last resort. Secondly, we will continue to care for all members of our community unless or until the money runs out. And thirdly, it is only through programs through the state in defining us as rural and the federal government and letting us defining us as a critical access hospital that we are continue to be able to survive and provide those safety net services. This is not a wealthy region. When I moved here in 1979, we were a timber-based economy. And as Senator Cruz knows, in his region, timber-based economies have not yet quite recovered from the 1980s.
Rick, that's an understatement.
So our hospital and physicians are continually challenged to provide high-quality care and the safety net care that we provide. And there are several programs, though, that taken in aggregate have allowed us to continue to provide the care that we are providing. First was the designation of this hospital as a Type B hospital by the state. As a Type B hospital, we qualified for cost-based Medicaid reimbursement, and our physicians qualified for a $5,000 a year tax credit in the state of Oregon. That tax credit has been invaluable to us in recruiting physicians for communities like Lebanon, Sweet Home, and Brownsville, and retaining them. Secondly, the federal recognition of LCH Lebanon Hospital as a critical access hospital has really been beneficial in helping us to get cost-based reimbursement from Medicare. Without the aggregate benefit of those programs, I doubt that we would be still here, and I certainly doubt that we'd be able to provide the scope of services that we do. My request to the committee is simple. If you want to keep primary care services in rural communities like Lebanon, Sweet Home, Brownsville, and Eastland County, you can do it in several ways. First is resist redefining rural. I know there's been a lot of issues around the liability insurance support program, but communities here in the valley and up and down the corridor still have the same problems as many rural communities. We're really not metropolitan.
Excuse me, Rick, have you been involved in the discussions of concerning the malpractice insurance assistance program, Senator Bates, court-sizing?
Yes.
Are you been involved in
this? Yes.
That? Yeah. Are you satisfied with the direction that?
I am. I was concerned under one proposal, which was, you know, in essence, to strip most of the I-5 corridor out of the definition of rural. And that would have eliminated Lebanon, Silverton State, and Grants Pass, possibly Roseburg, you know, communities up and down the I-5 corridor.
That is not...
I understand that.
Yeah, and that will come back before our committee.
But I do know that there is one piece of that bill that I think would be beneficial to our community, and that is that as employed physicians, we are not eligible for the malpractice liability support. When I talked about the wisdom of leadership here in the Mid-Valley, part of that wisdom was bringing physicians and hospitals together. And so all of the primary care physicians in Lebanon, Sweet Home, Brownsville are, quote, employees. While they work on a production basis and work hard, they are not eligible for the malpractice subsidy because the hospital is supporting them or employing them. So to me, it seems not to make sense to exclude them from that liability support, given that if a hospital wants to hire employ physicians to put them in rural communities, it makes no sense that those physicians should be excluded from benefiting from the liability support. Well, I think the liability support is not the solution to that problem. As long as that program exists, I think it should apply to anybody practicing in a rural community. Secondly, and this is directly with that, I think we need to continue to look at how the state can support rural. I think the tax credit, I think the liability support, and one problem that I don't know how we're going to get to, but has to do with debt load of incoming physicians. We see tremendous debt load. The average debt load now is between $150,000 and $200,000. And we've had physicians come and go because they were unable to meet their loan repayments. They are, in essence, starting practice owning a home without having a home. So if they want to own a home and pay back their loans, they are being forced to go into areas where they make more or into specialties where they might make more. I would be not covering the bases if I didn't say I think the most important thing is that we support some sort of universal health care coverage for people living in the state of Oregon. As long as we have high percent, and we're running close to 20% of patients with no health care coverage, we will be continually trying to figure out how to support those people through our safety net clinics, and we will continually be cost shifting the cost of their care to others who have insurance. So last I heard about Jim, the diabetic patient, he's continuing to struggle with his diabetes and his high blood pressure, but he has medicine and he's not been rehospitalized. There are a lot of other patients like him in our communities. There's a diabetic who lives under a bridge. There are many patients in their mid-50s who don't qualify for Medicare who have chronic diseases like diabetes, heart disease, and congestive heart failure and emphysema that this hospital and Samaritan Health have chose to help care for to try to prevent them from needing more costly hospital services. It's not perfect. You know, there are many areas that we struggle. However, we've made good progress, and a lot of that, I think, is to your credit in supporting rural hospitals.
Are you optimistic about the various programs that we're considering for health care reform? There are four plans altogether, and you've been involved in some of them. Do you think we're going to have something ready from your perspective, do you think we're going to be ready to pass out a bill this session?
I'm always optimistic.
Oh, okay.
As one person said, there's no future in pessimism. I think the question really is, are we going to be able to pass out something that can satisfy the broad spectrum of people that we're not creating and programs that are going to actually make it more difficult? I think there's a lot of support. I think with the former governor and the present governor and the legislative leadership, you know, seriously considering health care reform, I can't think of a better opportunity to move forward. So I'm optimistic. I would say I think there's better than a 50% chance that we'll pass out something. I certainly hope that our children's bill passes out without difficulty, but that will still leave over 450,000 people in the state of Oregon without insurance coverage, and I just don't think we can maintain. We will continue to work at it here in our communities, but it requires us to continually cobble together things like drug assistance programs and outreach clinics and volunteerism to make it work, and it's certainly full of holes. It is not a perfect safety net. So, while I'm optimistic, I understand that there is some concern in the part of legislators about the overall cost and the potential for expanding government under the current proposals. I would encourage you to at least put in place a framework to move forward. Otherwise, I think we'll be back here 2 years from now having the same discussion, unfortunately. Now, I'd like to thank the committee, and I'll take any other questions that I may or may not be able to answer.
Just a comment on the forest products industry. I have two mills in my district that were closed by Weyerhaeuser, and I've had some discussions with Weyerhaeuser about this, one in Springfield and one in Lebanon. Weyerhaeuser is getting out of the business, and that's been known for quite a while, and they're in the process of closing a lot of their operations.
In the Northwest.
And then, well, they're a worldwide company, and I spoke with one of the representatives yesterday about that, and he reaffirmed the fact that they are, you know, cutting back, and so it didn't help when they bought Willamette Industries, because they shut down Willamette Industries. In fact, that's the one they shut down now in Springfield.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, it's bleak, but I'm hoping that we will always be a forest products state of some in some dimension. Questions?
Yeah, sure. First, a comment on what you just said. If you look at where they're still thriving, which is in the southeast part of the United States, and look at the Forest Practices Act down there compared to ours, you would understand. Rick, I guess because you've been part of the discussion, a couple of questions, Mr. Chair, on the rural health liability is your issue of employee coverage. What reception have you got from this work group on that issue?
My discussion was directly with Senator Bates, and he certainly was supportive of the concept. I did not testify specifically to the committee or talk with the whole committee, so I really am not sure where that is at this point. And as well as what I'm, you know, talking about it, I'm always aware that things in the legislature can move in mysterious ways and sometimes quickly while one's not looking. So I'm just putting in my two cents that I really think, you know, I would use a community like Burns or, you know, even Sweet Home or Brownsville, where these communities would not have physicians if we didn't have hospital support for those physicians. And it just doesn't make sense to me that they should be excluded from the liability support piece.
Let me interject right here before. The mysterious way that this thing has happened is that this is a Senate bill that we have in our committee, and we ask them to report early on.
Mm-hmm.
Met with a little bit of resistance, but they did report, and they are coming back to us, and we will thoroughly discuss the findings, and this committee will make the final decision. They will make a recommendation, and we will consider the findings. So when we have the public hearing, we will open it up to all of the concerns. It's a very important issue. The definition of rural, we're not going to mess with, but underserved areas that are kind of in between, I think, need to be considered, and the prioritization of the types of physicians might be part of the criteria, but the selection process has to be tightened up, because I think currently it was just open up to anyone who qualified as a physician, and so that those are some of the things that we will be looking at. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, well, Mr. Chair, you and I have been involved in this for a long time, and I may slightly disagree with a couple of things you just said, but we'll save that for when we're back in your office.
I think part of our philosophy as Samaritan has been to try to keep primary care close to the communities. And I think that by keeping communities defined as rural and supporting primary care in those communities, either with tax credits or with liability support, we achieve that much better. And my concern is that if you start to take those things away, you'll start to see primary care leave, you know, smaller communities. I'm not saying we need to have every specialty in these communities, but we do need to have primary, you know, family medicine, internal medicine, pediatrics, general surgery, some of the orthopedics, things like that. As we all know, this debate over this started around plastic surgery, and that's one of the things that we go out of town to get, and we're welcome to get that out of town. But on the other hand, I want to be able to keep that primary care as close as possible.
Mr. Chair, I think it would be extremely important to at least have an amendment. I'm certainly willing to sign for it, or you, if it doesn't come out of the work group, so that we at least have a discussion about expanding the malpractice to hospital employees.
Yeah, see, we have employed physicians on the coast in Lincoln City, Newport, Depot Bay, Pacific City. You know, we have, and those, none of those individuals are eligible for this. So.
Yeah. Other comments? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Becky Pape, CEO. Welcome.
Thank you.
You welcome me, right?
Yes, I will. I will welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for being here at our committee. Thank you very much.
Thank you for coming, Senator. Thank members of this committee.
It's a pleasure to be here.
My name is Becky Pape, and I am the CEO here at Lebanon Community Hospital, and I would like to welcome you also on behalf of Oregon's 57 community hospitals, healthcare systems, and the patients we serve. I appreciate you letting me come and talk to you today. I'm here to offer testimony about the value of the Rural Practitioner Tax Credit and how this benefit can translate into providing medical care to a rural community. Specifically my community. Every year here, I am responsible for trying to provide the necessary resources to meet health care needs in this community. And for me, that most necessary resource involves providing enough physicians and health care providers to practice in primary care, obstetrics, orthopedics, general surgery, and internal medicine, because those are the people that walk through this door every single day, and we treat everybody that walks through the door here. I have to have physicians to take care of 2,000 patients every year that come to the emergency department, 2,400 that need to be hospitalized, 350 that will be born, tens of thousands that walk through the clinics in Lebanon, Sweet Home, and Brownsville. In 2006, about 70% of my patients were funded by Medicare or Medicaid, and only 20% had traditional insurance, and the rest were basically unfunded. It's not a lucrative market, and there are not a lot of CEOs lined up to try to get my job, because it's a very challenging community. Rural physicians, typically, they work longer. They work in a more challenging patient environment. They make less money than their urban counterparts, and they care for families on the entire continuum. We look for really special physicians that will do that. They have a sense of community, a philosophy about giving care to those who are unable to care for themselves. A large part of my population is not affluent. They're underinsured, they're underemployed, they're socioeconomically challenged. The system that we're a part of, as Dr. Wopat said, is very committed to providing care to whoever needs it. And we do that to the tune of millions of dollars a year. And I can give you those figures later if you're interested in. The point is that we, and I think you as government, you have to look at what would be considered reasonable in a community like this to help us provide physicians and other health care providers. And recognizing that this isn't like other venues. It's not like urban areas. I do think primary care is where it all happens. Prevention is cheap compared to an expensive complication. And I realize that the American medical system is it's a perverse in that it is it pays you to do acute, episodic, expensive rescue. But we are trying to change that here by taking care of people before they have a catastrophe. I think that this tax credit is small potatoes compared to the pay it forward that you will get. And it's really not about funding high tech or lining anybody's pocket. It's a program that's administered by the Office of Rural Health through the Health Sciences University. It gives physicians a $5,000 tax credit if 60% of their time is spent practicing in a rural area. I would ask you to think about doing what I do every day, which is to come into work and try to hold all this together with not enough physicians. And then try to compete with the whole rest of the nation who are trying to get physicians that are graduating, and only 4% of them are even considering coming to a rural community of 25,000 or less. It's not fun. But it can be done, and the right kind of people, I think, are very responsive. This tax credit is a very powerful tool to recruit and retain qualified physicians who will stay here for decades, who will be on our school boards, who will give care in free clinics, who will help us to make this community healthier. And I am asking you to respectfully preserve this tax credit. Thank you very much, and I'm open for questions.
Oh, one quick question. This is a national statistic, is it?
From Merritt Hawkins, the one about the physicians that consider coming to rural areas. Yeah, Merritt Hawkins is a recruiting firm, and those were some of the recent statistics we got at a seminar we went to. Scary.
It is.
It's scary.
It is. The other problem is the spouse of the spouse of the physician has to sometimes find an adequate job in a rural area, and that's the other consideration.
Absolutely true.
Consideration is what company or physician in their right mind would go to a place where they didn't have adequate schools,
mm-hmm.
and what company would move to a small community without adequate health care or schools.
Absolutely.
So this is an economic development issue, and the governor is interested in discussing economic development in rural Oregon, including health care and schools. So that's something that we've had some discussion with the governor's office recently. So that's good news, because, you know, we're talking family wage jobs.
Yep.
And I think it's a really important issue. So
I agree with you. We've tried to position ourselves here as not only a place to get health care, but a partner in economic development and recovery. The training center that you're sitting in, it's important, and you're right. No business wants to come anywhere where there isn't good health care. So.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Community Mental Health Services, Mike Todd. Would you come up, please, Mike? Angela, would you like... Where's Angela? Oh, I'm sorry. Angela, you can come up next.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Kevin Earls with the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems, and I'm here in place of Jane Ellen Whiteance, who is on your original agenda. And I'm joined by Michael Todd, who is the Director of Psychiatric Services for Mercy Medical Center in Roseburg. And our presentation will be brief. I know that your time is precious this morning and that you have a lot of ground to cover. We're here to focus specifically on issues of mental health and mental health service delivery. And we approach this presentation for you as follows. We've kind of divided this into two segments. I'll lead off with a brief kind of overview of the mental health system from a hospital and patient perspective, kind of at the 30,000-foot view. And then Mr. Todd will follow and give you kind of the case study of what's happening at a hospital level and a community level. So kind of both dimensions. And we're going to do it rapid fire, but we'd be pleased to take any questions that come up. First of all, for the record, I'm Kevin Earls with the Oregon Association of Hospitals, where I'm Vice President of Policy and Advocacy. So I'm going to give this operational overview, and it really starts with the first question: what happens when an Oregonian needs urgent mental health attention? what literally, from an operational point of view, what happens? Where does that service begin? Well, it begins as the patient either comes in on their own or is brought into a hospital emergency room. The hospital emergency room is literally the point of entry to the mental health delivery system for most people that have urgent mental health needs. So what's our statewide capacity to provide care of this kind? We have 278 beds among 16 hospitals statewide. So 278 beds total statewide, 16 hospitals, that's 16 out of 50. So 278 beds total statewide, 16 hospitals, that's 16 out of 57 hospitals have psychiatric beds in their facilities. How does that capacity stack up? Well, on any given day, all of those beds may be full. Or all the beds in many of those 16 units may be full. So we're running at capacity much of the time in this state. So what happens when the patient comes into the ED? Well, first, if it is a hospital that has one of those psych units, one of those 16 hospitals, you have to see if there's a bed open. And if there is, then you have the ability to transfer the patient to that bed. If not, then you need to stabilize and locate a bed for that person somewhere else in the state, at one of the other 15 hospitals. You have to stabilize and arrange for a transfer. So what does that involve? Well, you're transferring to an open bed. You're transferring a patient that is already stressed because of the nature of their medical condition, their mental challenge. And because of the dispersion of these beds around the state, the common phenomenon is that a person is transferred way out of their community, way away from their family, their support group. So there's distress and this transport issue. If the patient is assessed and found to need long-term care, a process is then undertaken to evaluate the patient for placement in an Oregon State Hospital. And then through that evaluation process, if it results in a commitment to the Oregon State Hospital, then the patient is in effect returned to the hospital, our hospital, one of the 16 hospital units, while they wait for an opening at the Oregon State Hospital, which can often run 30 days or more. So in effect, the patient goes through this evaluation. They're determined that they're a danger to themselves or others. They need to be committed. They need to be transferred to Oregon State Hospital. There's no room at the end. So they get returned to an acute care community hospital where they're in effect put on hold, waiting for the queue to resolve. And as I say, that can often take 30 days or more. It's worth noting that during that period, there's no payment associated with the patient. So they're in effect, they have to be in a psychiatric unit because that's an appropriate level of care, but it's a higher level of care than they require, and there's no payment. So this results in a fairly inefficient use of care for already scarce community hospital psych beds. The Oregon State Hospital also faces difficulty in discharging patients. So they can't, once a patient needs to be released into a community, there's a shortage of community beds for this step down to occur. So what I'm describing to you is kind of a system that's clogged. And it results in a severe degradation of patient care, a highly inefficient and expensive use of resources, lack of resources, and it's like a giant traffic jam. And I would characterize it best by describing a story that occurred last year in Oregon, in which a patient in the Tri-County area of Portland came into an emergency room needing psychiatric care one evening, and literally there were no patient beds available, psych beds available in the Portland area. The last bed in the state was available at Asante in Medford. The patient was transferred 300 miles down to Medford and admitted into Asante. That was the last bed that was available in the state. The next morning, a person that lives three blocks from Asante Medford came into the hospital needing psychiatric care. Of course, there were no beds available, but one had opened up in Portland. So that patient had to be transferred all the way back to Portland. So that characterizes the kind of challenges that we're seeing. And before I turn it over to Mr. Todd, the comment that I would leave you with is, from a hospital point of view, every hospital CEO knows one thing about psychiatric care. You're going to lose money. You're absolutely going to lose money. And it's kind of the nature of the care and the payment systems that are associated with it. But you do it because it's part of your mission and part of your commitment to the community. The problem with this traffic jam and this phenomenon that I have described is the hospital CEOs find themselves increasingly in a situation in which the patients that are in their psych units aren't from their community. They're from 100 miles away or 200 miles away because of this need to transfer people around the state. And so if you're a hospital CEO and you find yourself in a situation where you're losing money, but you're losing money not on people from your own community, it presents a real challenge in terms of evaluating the ongoing commitment. And with that, I think it's helpful for Mr. Todd to kind of give you a snapshot from in the trenches.
Thank you. I also appreciate being here and being able to give you a very serious vignette in our community.
And go ahead and introduce yourself.
I'm sorry. My name is Michael Todd. I'm the Administrator of Psychiatric Inpatient Outpatient Consultation Services for Mercy Medical Center in Roseburg. I've also, sometimes to my chagrin, I've been doing this 39 years, I realized a few months back. So I've been doing this a long time. There are many facts that I could give to you, and I will share a few of them with you, but I think I really need to speak from both a concern for our community and also just from my heart about what's happening to people, not only at our hospital and other hospitals. As I'm sure you have heard, Mercy Medical Center lost about $2 million last year on its behavioral health unit. The part that is significant about that is that it is at the point where it is jeopardizing the entire mission of our hospital. And the hospital is going to have to make some very hard choices on whether it can afford to fill that part of its mission and jeopardize the rest of its mission. Just to give you a vignette of how it affects our community as well as the entire state, A snapshot in January, in the first 2 week period of January, we had 110 people needing inpatient psychiatric services who came to our hospital emergency room. And the interesting thing about that period is that in terms of the actual admissions, In terms of the admissions in the first 2 weeks of January, there were 68 admissions in those 2 weeks. Half of them were from Roseburg, Douglas County, and half of them were from out of county, south of us, but also in Salem, Corvallis, Portland, and north. So the phenomena that we just heard described is very active in terms of the interdependency our communities have on one another. I think what I experience on a daily basis in terms of the people who come to us is that these are people who live around us. They're our parents, our mother and father, our sister, brother, our neighbors. And I often wonder in the month of January, what would have happened to those 110 people? Those 110 people would have had nowhere to go, and the 68 people who were admitted the first 2 weeks, 34 of them would have had nowhere to go in the other hospitals around the state. I think our community would suffer greatly. The emergency room in our hospital would crash and burn. That's just a fact. And I think we would see a tremendous impact on the emergency rooms of other hospitals, and we would have many, many more stories like the dreadful one we had not too long ago where a person was discharged and took their lives. I also want to just talk about the practicality in terms of dollars. I have practiced in four states and have toured many of the programs in many states around our country. And something that just struck at me that I happened to research a couple months ago was the state of Arizona has approximately almost double the population of Oregon with some very similar demographics. The state of Oregon has three times as many state hospital beds, those costly state hospital beds right now, than the state of Arizona does, which is a factor of about 5.5. And the reason that is that there's a system of community care in Arizona, and the front end is well fed, and those state hospital beds are not needed. Why that is significant is because if the community services, not only acute care, but if the community services are not fed, we will continue to need those costly high-end services. This did not happen in Arizona because the people of Arizona are better than the people in Oregon. It happened in Arizona because for two decades a federal judge directed the mental health system in Arizona, and another court monitor was appointed by a federal judge for kids. I have lived through that. It's not pleasant, and our state government would not find it pleasant either. Our governor would have an interesting conversation with Governor Napolitano in Arizona or Governor Wingle in Hawaii to find out what it's like to try to operate a system when the federal courts are directing it. I'm afraid we're headed in those directions. Things are so dire. We have, our CEO has had made a very hard decision that we may very likely close our services on June 1st. And the domino effect of that will be felt very, very quickly throughout the state as well as in our community. There are options for the utilization of our building, and there are some other needed services in the community, some of which you may have heard, that are being talked about. But the point I want to make to you is that none of those options will replace the basic acute care services. It's a service that when you don't need it, it's out of sight. When you need it, it is critical and life-saving. So while there are other uses for our building, and our county has been very cooperative, they are suffering all the rural issues that have been discussed on the medical side as well. But I have a very ambiguous thought on whether we will even survive and be there, and that would be tragic for our community and our state. One last thing I would like to mention, we were talking about doctors. I spent the last year of my life, much more of it than I would like, trying to recruit psychiatrists to Roseburg. It was very, very, very difficult, and we finally got an adult psychiatrist. We may lose the child psychiatrist we have coming in July, because no physician is going to come to town if they then do not have a resource to hospitalize their patients. There is at this point in time in Douglas County a population of 100,000 people. There is no child psychiatrist available to the general public. There is one child psychiatrist working for Douglas County Mental Health, and we are likely to lose the one who is coming. That is a very difficult thing, again, in terms of the front door and the outpatient services and all those opportunities to prevent people from coming into our system. I appreciate your time to better understand what's going on with us. We are blessed in Douglas County. We've had the support of our representatives and local county officials. We need your support as well.
Thank you.
Question? Yes, Mr. Chair. Those with mental illness and mental disorders need to have a much better system in the state of Oregon for their care. And unfortunately, the hospital right now is the one where there's a place that it has to go. I would love to see a system that has mental health crisis teams, that they and network with mental health crisis teams, where if a individual was going through a crisis, that then a team could come out and evaluate them, and then I feel that there needs to be a place for them to go. And that's where I hope, when we are revising and reforming healthcare, that we are looking at that. And I'm so excited about, first of all, getting the two mental health psychiatric hospitals built, one in Junction City and one in Salem. But then looking at the other systems of care for our 16-bed units. And again, I don't know enough to know how many patients you see that are that you're hospitalized. On an average, how many is that at Mercy Hospital? Do you have one a week? You know, 100 a week? And that's where we as a state have to start looking at that and then creating a system of care for them. And so there's a whole lot of work that needs to be done, and I know there's like over 200 mental health bills, and I happen to chair one of the health care committees, and I'm almost overwhelmed at okay, how do we do that? It's so fragmented. So anyway, just give me some input regarding about how many psychiatric patients you need to treat a week. Yeah.
Chairman Morissette, Senator Anderson, I appreciate your insight and the questions that come out of that. We admit about three people a day on average into our hospital. You also mentioned all those other services. I am very, very encouraged by the new leadership at Douglas County Mental Health. They are trying desperately to stand up alternative services that will prevent hospitalization. And we do have what are called soft admissions, people who are too ill and too dangerous to not do something with, but might have not come into the hospital if there were other services. The problem is, as you really alluded to, is that the last $1 million that was spent on acute care in Douglas County was taken out of the rainy day fund. They do not have the resources to deal with the current crisis of acute care and then to help solve and stand up those services that would prevent the crisis from being an ongoing way of life in our county. So we do have a catch-22 at the time, and I guarantee you that if we are not there in Roseburg, if our doors are shut, or even if they are diverted to some other worthwhile alternatives, the costs to Douglas County alone and to others in the state to transport them, coordinate their care, get them back from those other counties will take every last discretionary dime that they may have to build a system. So if we don't deal with today, we will not be able to deal with tomorrow.
What you can do is get the information to our committee staff, and if you want to add kind of a summary of what you're saying, that would be helpful too.
Thank you. I'd be happy to do that.
Yes, Senator.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I'm sure you're aware of the meeting held earlier in the week with folks in Douglas County, the hospital, and public health folks. We had a meeting, and just to report back to them, I begin conversations with Bob Nichols, so we'll see where it goes.
And I appreciate that. And some of the possibilities that were discussed during those meetings are helpful and may help the hospital not have its huge financial loss, may help provide some of those other very needed services, but will not, most of those options will not allow us to survive as an acute care service. And the problems I've described will unfold.
We did, I'm in the Healthcare Ways Assembly Subcommittee, and Bob Nichols was there to make a presentation, and we're not finished in the Ways and Means Subcommittee yet, so that would be anything that you have to submit in writing to us, and if you, you may already have done that, but this renews.
Chair Morse, we'll work to provide all the members of the committee with some additional detail. I think the takeaway in this particular example is Douglas County, or Mercy, is going to lose $2 million in their behavioral health unit this year, which leads to a $1 million overall loss for the hospital system. So, but for behavioral health services, they'd be in the black by $1 million, which is a nominal amount of money given the volume of work that they do. They have 29 of the 278 mental health beds in the state. When those 29 beds go offline, given what I told you at the top about capacity issues, it is literally going to be a domino effect. So this story that you heard is not about Douglas County. It's not about Mercy, because we have a statewide system that is barely hanging together, and when this piece goes out of the puzzle, the rest will crumble.
Wow. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Angela, do you have any good news?
Or a hard act to follow?
We have ways for you to spend money.
Well, we're running a little late, so...
I'll make it brief. Chair Morissette, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Angela Kimball. I am the Director of State Policy for NAMI National, and I'm here at the request of Jane Ellen Widens, who could not be here today. And just to follow up on what Kevin Earls and others have been talking about, I want to point out that the State Hospital Master Plan made it very, very clear, as others have today, that without front-end services and the backing for people coming out of the state hospital, we will continue to have very, very serious problems that are going to impact the entire system. In fact, our system is already in crisis. You can see it, you can hear it when hospitals say we may be shutting down our psych inpatient wards. That's a huge problem. So several months ago, last year, looking at the State Hospital Master Plan report, a number of hospitals, along with legal advocates, family advocates, psychologist associations, psychiatric association, all these different entities, including the criminal justice community, got together, which is an amazing coalition, and sat down and started to map out what do we need for a coherent community system that's actually going to provide that continuum so that we have stability in our acute care system and so that we actually have the services that help prevent people from not only getting to the state hospital but even into acute care, because that too is a system that needs to be managed carefully. So in the end, a number of psychiatrists, psychologists, all these different organizations actually mapped out a set of community services that we felt were priorities for our legislature to develop that will truly address some of these issues that you've heard about today. So this group put together a number of documents, and in the meantime, the state agency also started a community services work group and came to very, very similar conclusions. So the wonderful thing here is that all these groups have kind of converged and have a single message about where do we need to go next. And the message is really one that we can't afford to wait 5 or more years for a new state hospital building or two to come online. We need to start investing now, because every single day people are showing up in the emergency wards. And those who are not admitted are on the streets. There are the homeless folks. They're showing up in Dr. Wopat's clinic. They're under bridges. They're ending up in our jails. Some of them are committing suicide. So it's a real imperative to focus on that, and I think this is an incredible moment of time. I was so encouraged walking in here because, number one, the drive here is absolutely beautiful. The green grass, the lambs, and then walking down the hall and seeing these wonderful sayings in the windows, stained glass windows, let all that we do be done in love. And I'm thinking, you know, this is a really unique period of time.
when historically very different interests have come together and they have a single message for you, our legislature, and that is our mental health system, our community system has to be developed. It has to be invested in. We share this common concern. We do this out of a common love of humanity and taking care of individuals. That unites us. So, any questions?
Thank you. Well, Mr. Chair, I'd just like to comment. My committee is going to get all the mental health bills, and so we are starting on March 21st. It will be the first just explanation of what's happening on the siting of the hospitals, and then we're going to start in on the community mental health piece. So we may see you there.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Senator Ramos Anderson.
Yes.
Jay?
Yes.
Yes, I serve on Ways and Means, and I'm just looking at your money back here on your chart. And I'm just wondering, just take a line item like jail diversion and jail release programs. Was that component talked about at all through how the action would come to the legislature as far as your number obviously has increased the governor's budget? But is that just a number that you had there in December, or am I going to be looking at that number somewhere else? In the corrections budget, for instance?
Chair Morsett, Senator Berger, I do not believe that there is another mechanism other than simply through the budget process. There's not a separate bill for example, for that criminal justice component at this point in time. People are exploring, from my understanding, exploring different mechanisms for how to fund different pieces of this, because as you can see, there are different components. It could be done in a variety of ways, but I'd like to defer. I don't know if Mr. Earls has any additional information. Now that I don't work much in the Oregon legislature, so I'm a little less familiar with
We can deal with that in the ways. I'm also on the Ways and Means Health part of it, and we've heard some of this, and we can figure that out. The only other possibility for some additional money is through a beer tax that we have introduced for the last 30 years. We've also added some state police in there, but we hope that there will be some distribution to the mental health programs, because mental health and addiction problems go together and so on. But money is the problem.
So, Mr. Chair, could you clarify just for me this list that they have? Will we be seeing any of that through your subcommittee or for Ways and Means at all?
Well, we've talked to Bob Nichols made a presentation, and we haven't finished that part of the budget. And I'm glad that I'm hearing this now. And Senator Monis Anderson is in the policy committee that's hearing this. I'm in the Ways and Means part of it, and so I can't answer your question
right now.
But we will certainly be looking at it.
But Mr. Chair, you know, this brings up a broader issue, and I think we are not good at letting the community know where their tax dollars are going, because as you know, we are in a state that believes that they do not want to pay one more dollars are going, because as you know, we are in a state that believes that they do not want to pay one more cent to taxes, and it's very hard to meet the vast, complex community needs without the community support. And so we have a lot of PR that we have to do with those that live in our system. It's much, much bigger, because if they don't want to bring the money into the system, it's extremely difficult for us to be able to provide the services that are obviously necessary, just from the little bit of testimony that we got today. So I just have to get that on record.
Yeah, good.
People, we all do good things with tax dollar money.
Well, it's a cost shift anyway. I mean, besides, the cost of incarceration for mentally ill people who shouldn't be in jail is $60,000 a year or more. And so, thank you, Angela.
Thank you.
Frank Moreland, County Administrator for Mental Health. Could you give us a quick rundown, please?
Good morning, Chair Morissette, members of the committee. My name is Frank Moore. I am the Public Health Administrator and Mental Health Director for Linn County. And in the interest of time, I will be very brief. What I am prepared to say and what I'm going to say are two very different things based on what I've heard today, which is, for some people who know me, not unusual.
Can you move that other far away? That ringing is starting to bite
me. One of the things that's come up today, and I think it's important briefly for me to tell you about my background. I started volunteering at the State Hospital in 1973. I worked for 7 years for Sacred Heart Hospital on their acute psychiatric bed. It was a 29-bed unit. Then I went to Deschutes County, where I worked for 20 years, starting out as a crisis counselor, became the Human Services Administrator, and then after however many years that is, was burned out, took about 6 months off, came back to work for what was then the Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services as their Planning and Development Manager, and then finally had the good fortune of returning to Linn County in 2003 to be the Public Health Administrator and the Mental Health Director. And I say returning to Linn County as I was grew up in the North San Diego Canyon. I went to high school here in Ledman. I remember Ledman Community Hospital back in the 60s. And I see what it is today. And as Dr. Wopat said, it's due to some visionary leadership that this hospital is here. And I believe Dr. Wopat is one of those visionaries, and I've had the good pleasure of being able to work with him. And if you had the time and could sit in the entryway of this hospital, people who walk into this hospital take ownership for it as part of the community. And I think in many ways it's one of the few unifying elements of this community. And I think that's important because basically what we talk about when it comes to mental health and to any kind of health care, it is community and it is community ownership. That's where the services are provided, and that's where, as in Roseburg, I believe, that's how the investment in the community is what will help us with some of the acute care and the hospitalization issues and with the state hospital. And so, you know, I'm urging you not only to support acute care centers and hospitals, but also the community mental health system. To hear that Mercy Hospital would contemplate closing their psychiatric unit is appalling to me. I've been one of those people who, after the hours, juggles people and moves them around the state, much to my chagrin, transferring people when I was in Deschutes County from Bend to Lincoln City. And you know, that is no way to provide services to people. Obviously, it's not cost-effective. I think we have done a lot within the community mental health program system. We're moving to evidence-based practices. We've moved from models of treatment and illness to recovery and resilience, both in mental health and in substance abuse programs. But I think that if you take a look at what's happening in our communities, that safety, the safety net we used to believe that we had is pretty much eroded. People don't get into care within the community mental health system or the hospitals unless they have a mental illness and are significantly and overtly dangerous to self as others, as well as you well know. I think that the other piece that we're beginning to look at, particularly in Linn County, is residential placements. As you also know, in terms of what's happened at the state hospital, if you look at the population at the state hospital, approximately two-thirds of that population is a forensics population that present great obstacles when it comes to placement in the community. Linn County, at this point, quite frankly, if you were to take a look at the number of psychiatric security review board beds that we have for placement in the community, of the 13 beds that we either have, they're not beds, they're residential placements, of the 13 individuals that we have placed in Linn County, 4 came from Linn County. The other 9 we've accepted from other places, which I think demonstrates the county commissioner's commitment as a local mental health authority to basically work to solve the problem and resolve some of the problems with respect to maintaining people's tenure in the community, public safety, etc. So my urging is basically, you know, mental health problems, physical health problems are community-based problems, and that's where I think we begin to both the front end and that, as Angela said, at the back end, as people come out into the community, we are able to stabilize the system, and at some point we'll be able to at least make some headway. I gave you a copy of what are my budget presentations to the Board of County Commissioners this year. It shows numbers served, both for mental health, alcohol, and drugs. I think my business card is there. If I can ever have any assistance, please don't hesitate to call. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Yes,
Senator. Sure, thank you. He said, of your 13 beds, four of them are county residents. Do you have any county residents placed out of county?
Yes, there are three others that are placed out of county, either because we hadn't achieved development at that time or that because of their offense, it was not appropriate to relocate them back into the community from where they came.
Yes. So they didn't fit the criteria of the beds you have here. They were of a higher risk.
Chair Morrison, Vice Chair Cruz, not necessarily. We're still under development, and we probably will bring some of those people back. But in some cases, for persons on the Psych Security Review Board, their offenses have had enough visibility within the community that to return them to the community from where they came would not be appropriate.
Okay. So I guess I'm trying to get out because I think with the shuffling cross-jurisdictional, I mean, it's an interesting domino effect that a county is at capacity and so their people have to go someplace else, which puts them at capacity. So their people have to go someplace else. So, I mean, I think that's the significant driver here. I just want to get that point out. So thank you for giving me that.
Well, I'm sort of an eternal optimist, although sometimes I don't know why. But I'm quite excited to hear your testimony, and that's why it's so neat to come to places like this where we actually get to hear from you people who are doing the good service that we all so want to have, Matt. And we truly need to hear your stories, and hopefully we can get our act together in the legislature to really make a significant difference so that we can help the hospitals, but we can actually basically help the people who have the mental illness. That's the key.
Thank you.
We're going to move ahead, and we will break for lunch a little bit later. We'll be eating, some of us will be eating next door, so we don't want to break right now. Long-term care, Scott Bond, would you come up, please? And Nicole, would you come up?
Well, it's now afternoon, so I'll say good afternoon.
Thank you, Scott.
My name is Scott Bonds, and I'm the Director of Senior and Disability Services for Cascades West Council of Governments. Nicole?
For the record, my name is Nicole Palmatier with the Oregon Association of Area Agencies on Aging and Disabilities, O4AD. Okay.
So, I'm going to ask Nicole to kind of provide you a little bit of an overview of O4AD's work so far this session in looking at some of the long-term care and the developmental needs of our system. And then I'm going to talk a little bit more specifically about a couple of issues.
Thank you, Chair Morissette, members of the committee. As you know, Oregon has a phenomenal reputation across the nation for our long-term care system. We were the first to decide that maybe home and community-based care is not only something that our citizens and your constituents want, but also something that can be a better way to live, a better way to be able to stay in your home, to stay in your community, to remain engaged for as long as possible, and delay more higher-cost intensive services just a little bit longer. And we have a great reputation for doing that to the Medicaid-related population. We've done that really well in the past. We have over 80% of people who are able to stay in home community-based care. In other states across the country, that's exactly the opposite. 80% are in facility-based care. They do not have the option of doing the home-based care that we do here in Oregon. States are being incentivized by the federal government to actually change their system to follow Oregon. We've done a good job in the past, but you know, you can doing more with less is a great thing for as long as it lasts, but less and less and less all at once becomes insufficient. It's not enough anymore. And certainly Oregon's services to seniors and people with disabilities has taken a lot of heavy hits, and those people have been asked to carry a pretty heavy budget load in the past bieniums because of cuts.
programs such as Project Independence that we're also familiar with are fantastic, offer service with a little bit of care that people need to stay in their home, approximately $200 a person. However, when you have to keep thinning that dollar amount out to people, it really becomes not enough anymore. We've had a disinvestment in this population, our seniors and our people with disabilities, and we really feel that, you know, with the changing demographics that you all have heard so much about, the aging population that's coming forward, it's time to make an investment in it, not only to meet the care needs, but also for the reinvestment back that this population makes to the state. These people are not just people who need care. They are taxpayers, they're homeowners, they're volunteers, they're employers, they're employees. They're all these things within our communities, and we want to be able to engage them. They want to be engaged, and the way to do that is to meet them halfway, giving them the independence and choice within their local communities. There are some easy ways to do that. Yes, there are some ways that cost a little bit of money, but I think that the senior people with disability services sector has shown that we do a lot with just a little bit, and we can continue to do a lot more for this population.
Nicole.
Yes, sir.
The governor has done funny things with the budget, right?
Yes, I would.
Could you tell me what they are?
Certainly I can share more of that in reference to funny things.
On the record, funny things right. With the budget.
Funny things. For the record, I did not come up with that.
Roger,
description. In particular, there are a couple areas in the governor's recommended budget that some causes great alarm and some.
I'm talking specifically about Project Independence.
And that's probably the first and foremost. In the governor's recommended budget, Project Independence is recommended funding at $16 million, which is a great number. Last year we came out of the session with $12 million. Still not a complete restoration of Project Independence. And some of our area agencies are still facing a deficit at the end of this fiscal year before we hit the end of the biennium. They don't have enough money for OPI to make it through. But what the governor's recommended budget did is a little bit of a funny thing. There's no general fund commitment at all to Project Independence in the governor's recommended budget. It has been entirely taken out. Instead, it's been supplanted with funds from the Senior and Disability Property Tax Deferral
Fund. Okay, now, last session, we celebrated because we suddenly got a dedicated fund for Project Independence. And what this tells me is that dedicated funds mean absolutely nothing if there's general fund money that can be removed in their place. And that's what happened. And it's very, very, very frustrating. Now, we did get, you know, some excess money. That was that. And I know the co-chair of the Ways and Means in the Senate made a huge deal out of that, that we're going to really give you some. Well, and he intended to, but the governor took out the general fund, which is frustrating.
It's, Chairman Morris said, it's incredibly frustrating because as LFO described in their analysis of the governor's recommended budget, in my terms, senior property tax deferral funds are great. They were intended for the growth of Project Independence, not the survival. And LFO agrees that it's not a sustainable source of funding, as well as timing issues. If the budget stands, we're in some serious hot water come July 1st for Project Independence.
And again, hopefully Ways and Means will work on that. But it's a typical budget thing that happens a lot at state government.
That's
so
what I'm understanding.
Don't feel really good if you have suddenly dedicated funds.
We agree, Chair Morissette, and 04AD and our senior advocates and our people with disabilities are advocating for the restoration of $12 million in general fund, for supporting the increase in $4 million by the governor's budget for $16 million, and simply to protect the senior property tax deferral fund.
Okay, there's one other significant happening, because the bill last session included, a bill included the disabled.
It did.
In Project Independence. And the disabled were not in the bill before, so now they're in the bill. And they should have always been, but then that is going to require more money to cover them.
It is, Chair Morris, and the funny language in the bill says, at such time as funds are available.
Those are the weasel words, right?
Those are the words that say, yes, we want to do it, but perhaps we have to wait until such time as funds. And our goal was that the funds from the senior property tax deferral would be that growth and expansion money to allow younger people with physical disabilities to be able to enter Project Independence. But here we are 2 years later, and we're still waiting for that.
I thought you had good news.
What are my good news? We have some other things that we are working on this session. One of those is a bill sponsored by Chair Morris, the Older Oregonians Act, and that looks at investing in the population of older Oregonians who are not Medicaid eligible but not wealthy enough to provide all their own services, sort of the fall through the cracks group, the at-risk group, if you will. And there are a lot of small things we can do with programs such as foster grandparents, senior companion, meals on wheels, things that we can make small investments in that can create a pretty large return on investment, workforce development for seniors who either want to work, have to work, or, you know, need to be able to reenter the workforce and figure out how they can connect what they did before with what they're going to do in the future, planning programs to make communities more elder-friendly. And so we look forward to having that policy discussion and that budget discussion about really reinvesting in this population, because it's only to the benefit not only of your constituents but also of the economy of Oregon as a whole. There are a number of other things that you'll be seeing me talking about a lot during the session and seeing our advocates talking about a lot, and we look forward to continuing to talk about how we can do better in long-term care. Thank you.
That's good news. Thanks.
That is good news.
Okay. Questions? Okay. Scott?
Yes, Chair Morissette, committee members. I'd like to just tag on to one thing that Nicole said, and that is that when we do solve the problem that we discussed briefly about the OPI program and its funding, 2 years ago, OPI modernization really opened the door, I think, to a lot of very new and innovative things that can be done through the program, given that there is enough funding. When I look at coupling that with the possible work that can be created through an Older Oregonians Act and putting those two things together, I think what we see is a very powerful teaming of two policy concepts and program concepts that allow us to really create the kind of investments and the kind of infrastructure in this state that will help us to work through the issues that the baby boomers will present. The population changes that will be occurring over the next 5 to 10 years will require something more than business as usual, and it will require and push us to our creative maximum to be able to figure out how do we want to address some of these issues. You've heard evidence-based care. You've heard the term chronic disease management. In our world of serving seniors and people with disabilities, those are very important terms and very important programs that through OPI and through Older Oregonians Act, we potentially have the chance to create and replicate those programs all across the state. These are all very cost-effective programs, and they are able to really be created at a community level that addresses the community of Lebanon, the community of Sweet Home, the community of Albany, and what they need specifically in those communities, rather than some kind of a cookie-cutter approach that really doesn't fit some of the more rural areas of Oregon. So I really am looking forward to those policy conversations. To move from there, our long-term care system is, I think, on the cusp of having to really fairly face square on an issue of limitations of access. We are in the business of long-term care, which means that we're able to help place people who need care in an assisted living facility or residential care facility. foster care, in-home care, as well as nursing facilities. And in that range of continuum of care that we have in this state, which is not yet been fully replicated by other states, so we still have the vestiges of the claim to fame that the Oregon model is alive and well, but it's getting a little tattered. We're having some difficulties, and the difficulty is that when we are looking at creating access for people on Medicaid, it's getting to be a very difficult thing to do. We are competing. The Medicaid system competes with people who are able to pay for their care on a private basis. And for some of these levels of care, the range of payment through the Medicaid system is approximately $700 a month through about $2,000 a month. And in the private pay arena, providers can end up with $3,000, $4,000, or $5,000 a month for the same bed, if you will, the same bedroom in a facility. And we are, particularly in Lynn, Benton, and Lincoln counties, we're seeing some very very hard issues develop. In Lynn County, there are 7 assisted living facilities, for example, and only 3 of them at this moment will take a Medicaid client at the front door. In Benton County, there are 5 assisted living facilities, and only 1 of them will take Medicaid people at the front door. And when we look at some of the policies that are in place for the facilities, anywhere from 2 to 3 years of private payment of your own money is required to get in the front door, and then you can convert to Medicaid payment after that. But the barrier is growing, and in our same area, in Lynn, Benton, Lincoln counties, we have historically had the ability to place Medicaid people in what's called a specialized care unit or a memory care for people with dementia and Alzheimer's. And at this point, we don't have any beds. We don't have any facilities that will take a Medicaid person with this level of need. And so for every time there's a new limitation, for every time a facility says no, for every time we lose a level of care or an aspect of care which is needed for a senior or a person with a disability, those people don't just disappear and say never mind. We still work to find them the appropriate placement, and it's outside the community. Similar to the mental health conversation that you heard, we're in the business now of helping people find places to live in diverse regions across the state. We try to keep people as close to home as possible, but it's not always possible. There are the same limitations going on in other areas of the state as we have here, and it's the lack of access for the Medicaid client. There are certainly good business reasons. If I were to put myself in the shoes of somebody running a facility, facilities need to have enough money to run, pay the bills, answer to a regional or a corporate office that says, you know, here's how much profit you need to send back to the corporate office. I mean, these are businesses. I'm okay with that. I think we're all okay with that. We don't begrudge people the right to run a business and to support our clients in a very high quality way. But I think that the stumbling point here has been that we have not been able to engage in a full and robust conversation about what do we want from these facilities. What are the rules? What kind of expectations do we have of these facilities? And then how much are we willing to pay for that? And I know that there have been attempts to try to bring various budget packages forward, and they haven't gotten very far within DHS, frankly. but it tells me that we recognize as a system that we have a big problem. And this middle portion of our system, the foster care, the assisted living, the residential care, the specialty care units such as memory care units, we are not doing a good job of having the kind of clear expectations of what we want from those programs, and we're not doing a very good job of being able to spell out how much we're willing to pay in order to, I hate to kind of phrase it this way, but the price of admission, to take somebody without the resources and to get them the level of care that they need, we're not doing a very good job of matching the market. And I think that we as a system have some pretty important work to do to try to figure that out.
Just a follow-up on that, Mr. Chair, mm-hmm. And I know we need to get to lunch, but I had to put my father in assisted living. He's 87 and has Parkinson's. And thank goodness he has a pension that can cover the cost. But I get the sense we went through four of them in 1 year trying to find the right place. And some of them, I get the feeling that they just want to make as much money as they can. And I agree with you, and it would be nice to sit down at some point to try to figure out what we can do to regulate this type of thing. In 6 months in this last place, my father's care went up over $200 a month for his health care, and I think they got around it, and then his rent went up another $200. So that's, we're paying almost $500 more a month, which I think that's illegal, renter landlord tenant law, and I just haven't had the time to complain yet, but you know, I take care of his finances, and I can, thank goodness he has me, I mean, to do this. So it is a huge issue.
Yes.
A huge issue.
Yes, it really is. And I know that on the private pay side, you know, we as the kind of stewards of the public system, we don't hear a lot of the stories. We hear some, but a facility has the ability to say to somebody on a private payment that your care needs have changed, your whatever has changed, and now instead of $4,500 a month, it's $4,800 a month, and you kind of see that escalation. And again, I don't know that it's inappropriate. But I think that looking at what do we expect, and looking at compensation, and looking at the pressures that are placed on some of these facilities by corporate offices to, make more money for the corporate shareholders. I mean, it's a very interesting concept to have this public-private partnership, in a sense, with these facilities. And we could do a better job of balancing that, I think. In Lincoln County, I have an example that that there's a facility where we were given a 60-day notice that all of the 15 Medicaid clients needed to move out, and they need to be gone by April 8th. This is a relatively small facility, 27, 28 beds overall, I believe. We have had over the years, a fairly good relationship with this facility. And yet they have decided, the corporate office decided that they no longer wanted to be in the Medicaid business. We have taken the task of helping to find new homes for these 15 people in as positive a way as we can, but the tragedy is that these people are losing their homes. They are losing friends. They're losing family in the area. They're losing the familiarity of being able to live in the Newport community. And we're doing as good a job as we can to make sure that people who want to stay within Lincoln County can stay within Lincoln County. But about half of them are going to have to find a home, or have to have a new home outside of Lincoln County. Because in Lincoln County there are a limited number of facilities, and many of them don't take Medicaid, and the memory care, again, isn't in Lincoln County either. So when we're looking at access issues, there are things like this event in Newport which can really just blow the whole system up. In Lincoln County, I think this, the whole system in Lincoln County is going to become very, very fragile. We won't have very many options for Medicaid clients any longer. And it'll pretty much be a guarantee that people will have to move out of county, which is a very sad thing.
Mr. Chair, that's Blanca speaking.
Yes.
And the people are so traumatized by it. It's really so very sad. And I think that they really didn't expect it, unless my mail is different. But it seemed to just come right out of the blue to the people in Lincoln County. And that is not a rich county. That's another thing. There are many people that are eligible for that kind of living condition. So it is very, very sad.
It's very sad. And this same corporation has given notice to the state that it owns 17 facilities in Oregon, and they are all going to be put on what's called gradual withdrawal from the Medicaid program. So they will reduce their Medicaid exposure, financial exposure, through attrition, and they'll no longer be taking any more Medicaid clients into any of their facilities across the state. And so,
are they moving people out of any other facilities? Do they give notice for people to move, or are they going to take you not take any more?
This one facility in Newport is the only one where we've
so the others move. By attrition will
by attrition.
Yeah. Okay.
And so I bring that as another example where, with the loss of over this some period of time, an additional 250 beds across the state of Medicaid access for clients. That's the number of Medicaid beds that they are currently managing across the state. It begins to paint a picture for me as a director of a senior program that we're going to have to be looking at some very creative things. We're going to have to look at very hard at the choices that we give to our clients, and to be very frank with them in some of our discussions about what's possible and what's not possible. So at the client community sort of perspective, doors are closing all over the place, and that's not a good thing. At the policy level, what I hope is that we can look at the expectations, we can look at reimbursements, we can look at whether or not there may be some additional kinds of things that we can do that would reinforce the independence, dignity, and choices that we've always given people, the seniors and people with disabilities in our system, that we can reinforce that we really do care about where people live, that we have a cost-effective approach to how we support people on the Medicaid program, and that we are able to look at this as a positive challenge. I do also try to stay optimistic. I'm not sure how or why some days, but I try. And I would really like to see this opportunity as an opportunity to take us to some new conversations, because we built an Oregon model 20 years ago. We created ORS 410, which really established the basis for how we treat seniors and people with disabilities in this state, and I know that we can do it again.
There's another issue. Those who are wealthy don't have a problem. But now that there are more and more of us baby boomers that are getting up there, and we're middle class.
How about parents of baby boomers? We're getting there too.
Faster. what I am concerned about, because people will learn to work the system, that a lot of children will make sure that their middle-income parents spend down their money and get them into an environment several years ahead of it, so that they will be eligible for state funding. I don't know if that'll happen. I don't know if you see if it's happening now. It's no way the way we're set up. You know, people are learning what they're going to need to do to make sure then that the state will pay for their parents when they get older. So that do you see that as an issue at this point?
I think that we probably see some isolated incidents where that occurs. What I hear from our staff is that people still want to retain the respect and their dignity and pay their way to whatever extent is possible. And I think sincerely people really still do everything in their power to not be seen as a burden and to not create a situation for themselves that they feel that they're burdening either their family or the taxpayers some unfair way, and that mostly we see people with that motivation. Not to say that, you know, there aren't people out there trying to
work. I just know a couple of friends, families,
yeah,
who have done that with their parents.
Yeah.
So.
And you can do that. And you can do that if you've got the money, because you can work with attorneys who can set up, you know, a variety of legal situations, trusts and whatnot, that would allow for things to occur. But it is, it's not the majority of the people that we see.
We're talking about assisted living in adult foster care. Right.
And residential care
facilities. Yeah, right. Now, what about adult foster care? What are the current levels, pricing levels, that you're familiar with in adult foster care?
Let's see.
Well, my mother,
who
was in adult foster care and she could not do anything for herself. We were very lucky. It was only $2,200 a month. My father, on the other hand, is got more mobility, but he's $3,700 a month.
And that's an adult foster care. Okay.
So the current Medicaid rates for adult foster homes starts at about $950 a month. And goes up to about $1,650 a month.
So they're significantly
from a Medicaid payment structure. And again, just like in the assisted living, there's Medicaid and then there's private pay.
And then the residential.
And the same thing for residential.
Any other questions?
Okay. Thank you very much.
Okay. Now we have a number of people who have signed up. And how many of you are here for the long-term care? Okay. And how many are here for the bill that we're going to be hearing later? Okay, let's do a couple of long-term care fairly quickly if we can. That way we can break for lunch and, pardon me?
There's more people coming later for the bill.
Okay. Those of you are here for long-term care, would you come up, please? If two of you could come up. Yeah, good. And we'll do that, and then we'll take it. Introduce yourself for the record.
For the record, my name is Suzette Boydston. I'm the director of the Senior Companion Program that's sponsored by Samaritan Health Services. I live in Albany.
Okay.
I'm also here today as a daughter.
I'm Judy Wilson, and I'm here as a daughter. I have a mother who is living in a assisted living right now, and I wanted to just kind of help you see what has happened in our case with her. She is almost 100 years old.
Okay. Now, we are, unfortunately, under kind of a time.
Well, I gave you an extensive written testimony, and I have more words and passion than you have time for. So I will hold still that the testimony that I wrote will give you all the information you need if you do, in fact, read it, and I'd appreciate that. But we are in a crisis for long-term care for our Oregonians. We are definitely already on the Titanic when it comes to Medicaid beds. It's serious business, serious stuff, and some really serious discussions and decisions need to be made in order to take care of the people who took care of us for all these years. I wrote down 1,000 notes, but just to let you know that, you know, spin down, where would they go? They don't have any money. Where would they go for their care? That's a huge issue. So I don't think that's going to be a problem about spending down, because there aren't any Medicaid beds that would, you know, I mean, that's one of our greatest fears. The new physicians and his spouse and his families that want to move to our areas, I hope they don't bring grandma with them, because it's a serious issue. And yes, we have been model programs for 20 years, but we are really facing a crisis. Thousands and thousands of boomers are going to be retiring. What are they going to do? And they're not all very wealthy. Only a third of our aging population even have the funds for more than a year in a nursing care facility. And so it is serious business. Read my testimony. You'll understand more about it. I do direct a program that is an answer to some of the issues, which is trying to bring in care when they just need a little bit of extra help in order to stay home longer. That's huge. That's very important. And it's a cost-saving measure. We need to support programs like that. Ours is actually supported in the Older Oregonians Act. But clearly, we all need to put our heads together and really work closely and hard with our businesses and our communities and ourselves and our daughters and our children on what are we going to do in the future in the next 20 years. There won't be a place for all of us.
Okay, thank you. We will be hearing another. We will have another hearing on long-term care. And I do belong to the governor's task force, our commission on senior and disabled, mm-hmm. and I know that they're dealing with this issue. And so we'll
be there.
We'll thank you.
Chair, may I thank you for your personal story?
Okay.
Thank you. Yes.
Thank you very much, Senator Morissette. You probably remember last time you heard me, I was talking about my son who has a mental illness, mm-hmm. and we were looking for medications for him at that time. I appreciate all the help that you were for him with his Clozaril. We did get his Clozaril, okay?
And we put you in touch with the pharma representative, Novartis,
mm-hmm.
and he helped you.
Yes, he did.
Good.
Yes, thank you. We've had our medicine ever since. Thank you. And I want to just, Suzette's mother and my mother were in the same assisted living facility, so that brought us closer together, too. But I just want to tell you, mother and dad were, you know, back, she's almost 100 now.
Could you identify yourself for the record, please? I'm sorry.
Yes, I'm sorry. I'm Judy Wilson.
Hey, Judy Wilson.
Yes. Okay. And
for the record.
Oh, yes, for the record. They grew up, like we were saying, and just a little bit ago, you take care of yourself. You don't rely upon the system. And so I can remember many times hearing my father talking to his brothers saying, well, how much money do we really need? How much can we save, you know, so we don't have to rely on the system? We don't know how long we're going to live. Well, father passed away 23 years ago, but mother is still with us and still very knowledgeable about what is going on in her life, but she does not like to be helpless in this wheelchair. She fell in 2003 and broke a hip, and since then she has been confined to a wheelchair, and we moved her at that time when she was 96 about to the assisted living facility out here at Wynwood in Albany. And she has been there since then. It has been a quality of care. I have to be the advocate there, as we all have to be for our families who are disabled and who are seniors. But in 2005, after paying $72,000 for those 3 years she was there, we had to put her on Medicaid. And so I shudder when I hear things like Scott is talking about here today, as the Altera facilities are going to be sold or are sold right now to another company, Brookdale. And I'm trying to find out, does Brookdale take Medicaid also, you know? My husband says, don't rattle the cage, Judy, be quiet. So anyhow, but I just want to know, I came here in 1988. I was born in Oregon and then came back in 1988. And my friend in high school said, Judy, we are the sandwich generation. She said, you are taking care of your son. My son is now 48. With a mental illness diagnosis. Now I have a mother who is almost 100, and here my husband, 82, and me, 72. We're right here in the middle, and we have, you know, we feel this great caring and responsibility for these, our family members. So I just wanted to share that with you today, and we look for us having long-term care in our state that will help not only my mother, but will help us as we get up in those years also. Thank you very much.
Judy, did you ever get an Oregon prescription drug card? Because that's what we talked about that day, and your son didn't have, he wasn't old enough to qualify, 54
right.
And older, but now we have uninsured.
Yes, I know that, but you know, I found a Part D drug plan, and then working with them and advocating, I got all of his meds covered.
That's great. That's yes. Great. Our card will work with Part D, so you can use that for whatever the best price
is. All we have now is the copay and one medicine that it won't cover.
Okay.
So
let me talk with you about that.
All right. Later. Okay.
Good.
Thank you.
Thanks. Thank you very much. Do we have other long-term care? Yes, why don't you come up? Well, we can't leave these people.
Thank you for staying for lunch. Now I'm going to hurry because I know everybody's hungry.
Relax. Introduce yourself for the record.
My name is Gail Blasquez. I'm the Program Manager for Senior and Disability Services at Oregon Cascades West Council of Governments. I also live in Albany and have been a resident of Linn County for 33 years. By education and experience, I'm a social worker and I'm an advocate. But at this time, I'm also currently in a management position in the agency where I work daily with case managers, along with senior and disabled clients and their families. I've had the pleasure of doing social work in Oregon for about 18 years, first in the private sector and now in a government agency that predominantly serves Medicaid clients. Oregon's model, its continuum of care, as we call it, has always made case management a rewarding profession. It's fostered independence and choice, dignity, diversity in living situations, and it's been inclusive for those with the greatest need. The trend over the last few years has been discouraging and disheartening to both agency staff as well as clients, their families, and their support systems. A care system that used to be inclusive has become exclusive. I do want to just echo some of the things Scott said without being redundant, but we still serve proudly over half of our clients in the in-home end of the continuum with service plans that augment community resources to maximize support and safety. These plans generally fulfill client choice and our mission to keep people at home in their community at a cost-effective tab to the state of Oregon. We are proud and committed to this, but in-home plans are not working for all of our clients. Not only have they not ever been perfect for all people, but today there are other constraints. Home care worker salaries have risen to the point where putting a plan in place that often requires 24 hours around-the-clock care is often higher than a nursing home cost. If living caregivers are required, the salary plans are lower, but it is often challenging and impossible to find a live-in provider who's qualified and reliable to provide care around the clock. Some clients are lucky enough to have natural supports who help through these in-home plans that are difficult and extenuating. Some of those supports today may not always feel so lucky with the pressures of that. The middle of our continuum where the choices have been adult foster care, Alzheimer care units, residential care, and assisted livings are literally collapsing for our Medicaid clients.
The reason for this is primarily the Medicaid reimbursement is not adequate. For example, our adult foster home providers are willing to take higher care need clients, but the exorbitant insurance rates and the high care needs of these clients that require additional staffing makes it cost prohibitive for them. A private pay resident who can pay anywhere from $2,000 to $4,000 are offset the cost for the provider, but unfortunately with Medicaid clients they lose money. At the other end of our continuum is our nursing home care, where it's an appropriate setting for rehabilitation and for 24/7 nursing care, but it's expensive, and it's an institutional part of our system that clients, their families, and case managers consider temporary or when all the other options have been exhausted. The other options, however, are becoming more and more exhausted and unavailable. Most of the facilities, the assisted living, and specifically our Alzheimer care units in Linn County and Benton counties, will not take Medicaid clients at admission. The ones that do take Medicaid have a long waiting list, sometimes up to 20 people. When your client needs care and support, they don't have time sometimes to wait. They often choose, and we help to provide service as much as we can to help them stay at home and be safe, but it is often at risk. Real clients with real situations that I staff every day in the last couple years include people like couples who have been married 52 years in their late 70s, early 80s. The Mrs. has Alzheimer's disease. The in-home plan is no longer working when she becomes exit-seeking, combative, and resistant, and her husband is often frail as well. With all the supports that we can provide, it becomes impossible at times. And when a husband decided to place his wife in a special care unit, it was difficult enough, but then to have to apply for Medicaid and find that he could not admit her anywhere in his community was also disheartening. Finally, he told me on the phone, "I can't place my wife where I can't go visit, and I can't have meals with her like I have for 52 years. But my daughter finally convinced me that I was at the end of my rope, and he was becoming frustrated and exhausted. She was placed in Salem, which doesn't seem like a long way for us to go to the mall or to go shopping, but for him, who is starting to have failed vision and difficulty driving, it's a hardship. To not place her would put both of them at risk. Another story similar, a wife who's on a waiting list. Her husband doesn't even know her, but she can't bear to send him somewhere she can't visit. She too has cancer. He is on a waiting list, and this week we learned that 11 facility had 3 Medicaid openings. When this is often happens when their census gets low and they decide we'll take Medicaid clients, we now have 6 people vying for these 3 spots. The facility will choose who they will take. It is not necessarily first come, first serve. And unfortunately, they'll choose the client with the least amount of needs for the reimbursement they'll get from Medicaid. This couple may not be chosen. This past week, I just want to add one other protective service that we had with an elderly gentleman who required immediate intervention and care. He lived in a trailer with minimal furnishings, no heat, no refrigeration, not taking his medications, and he was depressed. His needs could be met in an assisted living, and he agreed to go. He told his case manager that he was actually lonely and that he would benefit from the socialization and camaraderie. There are no Medicaid openings. He needs some assistance. He is on a waiting list as well with our interventions. I could tell you the stories all day, but it is lunchtime. Same songs, different verses. It used to be these were exceptional stories. Now they have become the dilemma of the day for our case managers and our clients and their families. As I started, I'd just like to say I am a social worker and I'm an advocate. And I am deeply troubled by the concern that I have for the continuum of care collapsing in our state. Many people will outlive their resources. Seniors of this generation find it difficult to accept financial help. They are proud people who have lived through a depression and have worked hard on farms, in mills, as teachers, and homemakers in their own communities. These seniors, along with younger people with disabilities, through no fault of their own, require financial assistance to get the care they need. Together, we're all trying to save their independence, their dignity, their psychosocial well-being, and importantly, their relationships in their communities. In Oregon, it used to be a joy to do social work. It was easy to problem-solve situations when we had choices for people, and today it is a struggle. Case managers often tell me it is so hard to say to a client, "I'm sorry, this provider doesn't accept Medicaid at the door. You just can't move there."
They tell me that our clients are suffering because of their payment source, and that is true. I hope in this legislative session that you can find a way to revitalize our model of care in Oregon. I hope you'll review the Medicaid reimbursement rates for all licensed providers and find some equity. Seniors and people with disabilities should be not put at risk or isolated from their families and community in order to find care in a continuum that is shrinking up for them. Thank you.
Thank you. When I was growing up in Montana, many years ago, I was a depression baby. I was born in 1931. And my father had a pretty good job in the foundry, the smelter in Anaconda, Montana. I can remember him talking about the poor farm.
Mm-hmm.
And how he hoped he didn't have to go to the poor farm. Now, they own their own house. Luckily, before he had a high blood pressure stroke and was disabled for the last 15 years of his life, he did have pretty good insurance, and so our family did not have to go to the poor farm. And I thought we were... Before he had a high blood pressure stroke and was disabled for the last 15 years of his life, he did have pretty good insurance, and so our family did not have to go to the poor farm. And I thought we were beyond that point until now. And now I'm wondering if we will create poor farms somewhere where we put people, where people can go if they have absolutely nothing and if they're not covered. And if Medicare does pay something. But we're getting back into the depression days in times of, well, I don't know if we're in times of plenty, but we're getting back into those that time period now, which is interesting. I have 8 kids, and I don't want to live with any of them, and I'm too late.
You will be living at risk in the community, but we'll be helping you.
Well, I don't want to have to take care of them either, because that's the other thing. You know, I may live long enough. My oldest daughter is 54, but she is married to a wealthy attorney, and she works, but they're taking care of their grandkids and their great-grand. It's crazy.
Yeah, we're in a caregiving society, for sure.
Okay, now, thank you very much. I'm going to stay right here. We're going to break somewhat for lunch. I don't eat lunch, and I lose 20 pounds during the session because I don't eat lunch. I eat breakfast, I eat dinner, I don't eat lunch. So I'm going to sit right here. We're going to continue the public hearing. So if you guys want to go in and, those of you who are used to eating lunch, may want to go in and get a bite to eat. I'm going to stay here.
Okay.
Well, because we have a lot of people, we have a whole new group of people who have come in. We want to be out of here in an hour.
It ain't going to happen, Bill.
It ain't going to happen. So next, yeah. Well, if you want to do that, that's fine.
Have a working lunch.
Pardon me? We'll have a working lunch. Yes, we'll have a working lunch. Okay, good. We're still on long-term care. Who else has not had a chance to speak on long-term care?
And Alana thought there wasn't going to be anyone here today.
They were around.
Bill, we're still going, so you want to recess it just for 5 minutes?
Okay, let's recess for 5 minutes, please. That's for the record.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. For the record, my name is Mike Bopey. I have multiple sclerosis, and I've been receiving long-term services through Senior Disability Services for 13 and a half years. I've been able to live in my own home and been able to enjoy the company of my friends, be able to participate in social events. Probably most importantly, I've been able to participate in community events. I've been able to go to the legislature. I've been able to to advocate with other people for services within seniors and people with disabilities. And as a result, I think that a lot of the programs within that organization have been, they get a little different taste because they hear about us and they get a direct line about what it's like for the people who are receiving the services. And when I first started receiving services, this is in 1993, and I really had no, I was not afraid of possibly losing those services and needing to use a live-in provider as opposed to the hourly paid. The last two or three sessions, I have had that concern. And with the degree of my disability, needing to go to a live-in provider would alter my life tremendously. You can probably imagine the amount of work it takes to get me looking like this and sitting up in my chair again every morning. It's a 2.5 hour process just for me to get out of bed. I do the bed bath. I do virtually everything in bed. And to ask one person to do that 5 days a week, weeks on end, that would be a very, very difficult thing for one person to try to do. And also, because you've heard a lot about the pay difference about from live-in and hourly paid, the quality of the providers would differ, would be quite a bit lower with live-in providers as well. Just because the people who are paid a little bit higher, they have more incentive to provide better services. And I think that's what I would like to say. Any questions?
Mike, thank you so much. You're an inspiration. Truly an inspiration.
Thanks, sir.
Thank you very much. We're going to open a public hearing on what's that bill?
I think there's one more.
Long-term care. Oh, yes, I'm sorry. Would you come up, please? Okay.
My name is Jane Bartildis, and I'm from Newport. I haven't done this before.
Well, relax. When you're ready.
My mother lived.
Would you move the microphone just a bit closer, please?
My mother lives in an assisted living building in Newport, and about 30 days ago, this facility decided to terminate its Medicaid contract, and they gave the residents 60 days notice. Their issues were supposedly about, you know, the amount of money they're getting reimbursed for services and the level of care that the state was expecting them to provide in an assisted living facility. I'm pretty new to this whole process, and the things that I've learned just over the last year lead me to make a few suggestions. And I'm sure you guys have heard it all before, but buildings that resign basically from their Medicaid contract only have to give the state 60 days notice. And 60 days is just not enough time, and
culture that we live in. I had already started looking for my mother a new place to stay in November, and I have been on waiting lists since November. One place I called recently, if they take Medicaid, they have a big waiting list. One place had 60 people on their waiting list. And I'm talking to people, you know, I live in Lincoln County. We have two assisted living facilities and one nursing home. And so I'm talking to people south to Florence, north to Lincoln City, east to Albany, Corvallis, Salem, McMinnville, you know, all of those directions. And I've been on waiting list since November for another place for her to live. I've heard of people being called up to a year later that they finally have something available. So I think that the 60-day notice is just truly inadequate. If they're going to resign from Medicaid, they have to give more than 60 days notice, I would hope. I also understand that the contracts that the facilities sign with Medicaid is only for a 2-year period. And that also seems like a very short time frame. You get your family member into the facility. You're already in a state of flux. It's very stressful. You know, you're weighing all these things. You get them into the facility. And truly, it never crossed my mind to ask when this facility last signed a Medicaid contract. You know, it wasn't something I would have thought of. And as it turned out, my mother moved into this facility kind of in the middle of their Medicaid contract and less than a year ago. And so she's already, you know, being called upon to move out again. It seems like a 3 to 5 year contract would be a little more appropriate. I know that a new cell phone service contract is 2 years, and I think Medicaid is a lot more important than that. This particular facility in Newport evicted 15 residents, more than half of the people that they had living there, because of their ongoing sort of dispute with the state about the amount of services that they needed to provide. And they didn't seem to give the state any indication this was going to happen, at least to the level of the caseworkers. They had no indication that this was going to happen. And I think that I feel like these private companies obviously have a right to not take any Medicaid. But I think that when they bail and they leave a place like Newport in a situation where they have 15 Medicaid residents to place and they have one other assisted living facility in the town, that when they decide to come back and re-sign a Medicaid contract, you know, there needs to be a little more commitment. There needs to be some hoops that they have to jump through in order to come back into the fold. They need to sign a longer contract. Maybe they need to come in at the same rate they went out in. This facility looks like they're using a very strong arm tactic to tell the state, we want more money, or we don't want to provide this level of services in this facility. And they will decide to come back in, because this is the rural coast. They're going to need that Medicaid money. And when they do it, I think that the state should sort of negotiate from a position of strength rather than desperation and, you know, tell them, you bailed on us. You were not loyal to us. And, you know, we need to have a little more assurance. I don't know what the answer is there, but I definitely think there should be a waiting period before, when you leave your Medicaid contract behind, there needs to be a waiting period for you to come back in. Because we're talking about people's lives here. We're jerking people around. And, you know, if we're only signing for 2 years, it's not enough time. A couple of other things is I've been looking for places. You know, they talk about the assisted living and the foster care haven't received a rate increase recently. I don't understand it all, but I can tell you this. My mother in an assisted living, the state is paying $2,500 a month, for which I thank you all very much. If she went into a foster care in Lincoln County, if I could find one that would take Medicaid, it would be less than $1,500 a month. So there is a huge disparity there, and I don't believe you can care for somebody on the $1,500 a month.
in the rural areas.
Excuse me, you're saying that the adult foster care home in Lane County would be $1,500 a month?
Lincoln.
Lincoln County, and as opposed to
assisted living was receiving right about $2,500. Yeah, I was very shocked when my caseworker told me that. Okay. Seemed like a big difference. Also, there's a gap in the rural areas for any care between assisted living and nursing home. Newport has two assisted livings and one nursing home. But there's really not anything like memory care, Alzheimer's, that's not there at all in the rural areas. My mom is young. She's only 74. She's been in this process already for 6 years. And there's nothing. And we're used to driving when you live in Lincoln County. But still, you would like to keep something a little closer to home. Perhaps the rural area caregivers on assisted living need to be regulated a little different than the valley caregivers, because they truly do have a monopoly there on care. There's not the competition, you know, that there is throughout the valley. I also think it could be important to get a little more information about the Medicaid expiration dates, either in their disclosure notices or, you know, if a facility has its Medicaid expiration date coming up, perhaps families could be notified so that you would at least be aware that, you know, this was something you need to think about.
Excuse me, maybe that should be part of their, every application should list when the expiration date is. That should be something that everyone should know up front.
I think it should be one of those little places where you put your initials.
Now, I'm not going to ask somebody to come up and talk right now about the feasibility of the suggestions that you're making, but we will take this back with us.
Yeah.
And I would like to be sure to have your address and phone number and everything so we can be in touch with you, and your state senator is sitting right down at the end of the table here, and I'm sure she wants to know this too. But the points that you're raising are, I think, are excellent points, and I don't, you know, that's something that we'll look at to see about how.
Yeah, I'm just, you know, bringing the information to put it in front of you. I'm actually kind of, it's an interesting process to see here. The only other thing I wanted to say was, I think that when these facilities decide to bail from Medicaid, there should be a process. Mm-hmm. This particular corporation says they've been negotiating with the state. I don't believe it's true from what I've seen. You know, there hasn't been a lot of truth coming down. And, you know, there needs to be a process so that the state really does understand why they're negotiating or why they're bailing. You know, they rather than just not re-signing their Medicaid contract, it seems like there should be several steps so that the state can have, you know, like, kind of like an exit interview. So the state has information as to why the people are leaving. That's all I have.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate you did very well.
Yeah.
Thank you.
And please, pardon me? Oh, well, okay, say your name for the record one more time. You did at the beginning, but say it again.
Jane Bartoldis, Newport, Oregon.
Okay, and we would like to get your address and phone number and everything else before you leave.
Okay.
Good. Okay, we will close the public hearing on long-term care and open the public hearing on Senate Bill 8.
648.
Kevin. Ah, there you are. Now, we're not going to do a work session today, but we will come back. When?
On Wednesday.
On Wednesday, we're going to come back and do this again. Not here.
Over here.
Unless you're invited back for lunch.
You don't do lunch?
I don't do lunch. I know. I'm like a camel. I'm burning up the excess. Build up over the intro.
I would never compare you to a camel, Senator.
Catherine.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Catherine White, and I'm with the Oregon Council on Developmental Disabilities. And in the interest of time, I'm going to keep my comments
really short. I understand we're going to have another hearing on Wednesday, but we're here to talk to you a little bit about the Lifespan Respite Program. And we have a number of people here who will not be testifying in the interest of time again, but who came from some distance. So I just wanted to say that this is a program that people care very, very much about. We have representatives from Marion Polk who will testify, Lane County, Yamhill County, Lynn Benton, Wasco Hood River, Deschutes, Crook, Jefferson, and Tillamook.
Wow.
So this is a program that people care very passionately about. I want to simply set the context for the testimony that you will hear today. There are really, the original Lifespan Respite Program was passed in 1997. Thank you, Senator Cruz. There were a number of people around at that time who were involved in it.
Good job.
There are really two issues that face the program today, two major issues. One is the administrative structure and the implementation of the program and funding. Over the years since the bill was originally passed, we've seen erosion and neglect in both of those areas, in the funding and in the administration of the program. This bill is specifically focused on addressing the structure and the administrative portions of the Lifespan Respite Program. It really clarifies state and local responsibilities, reorganizes the advisory council, and expands some of the allowable usage of dollars. And I just want to say that this is a piece of legislation that was designed to address an issue of coordinating temporary relief care in each area of the state. So in the best of all worlds, a family, an individual who needed care or some relief from their caregiving responsibilities could call one place and they could find a caregiver, whether they were a senior, whether they were caring for somebody with a mental health condition, somebody with a developmental disability, a child. So this was an attempt to kind of pull together and create an efficiency in service delivery. You'll hear a little bit more about some of the issues and the challenges today, and then we'll be talking a little bit more about it on Wednesday. And I would be happy to answer any questions, or you can ask questions on Wednesday.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
For the sake of full disclosure, I was involved as a freshman. The driver at that point in time was a gentleman by the name of Bob Repine, who happened to be co-chair of Ways and Means.
Nice.
Which made it slightly easier to do. So.
And Mr. Repine is doing an excellent job with the state of Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
He's continuing to do an excellent job in various roles.
But I wanted to give the appropriate credit to the main driver at that point in time.
Yes. Okay.
So my name is Leanne Riles, and I am first and foremost a caregiver. I have a almost 24-year-old son who has been disabled since birth. So I've been walking this walk for a long time. He's partially paralyzed and medically fragile. And this gentleman right here to my right here, he had a perfect lead-in to this, exactly what we're talking about today with respite care. I also happen to be the program coordinator for the Lifespan Respite Care Network in both Marion and Polk counties. And I'm one of the original, we used to say counties, I'm calling ourselves the original 13 colonies now, because I'm still around after, you know, being hired as one of the original coordinators to do this program. And I can't even begin to tell you how many families we've helped. The need for respite is just huge. We didn't have it around when my son was little. And I'm here to tell you what the stress does to people who are caregiving 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. It just never goes away. So when the original Lifespan bill was passed, I was absolutely thrilled and excited to be a part of it. at least for Marion and Polk. Now, the programs are run a little bit differently in every county main estate, but for Marion and Polk, our main process and the whole goal of LifeScan is to match up family caregivers who need respite with providers who can provide that service. And the fact that we do serve across the age span from birth to death and all disabilities makes us a pretty unique program. So we're not specific to any type of disability or any age group, and that's just really cool because we just need to help everybody. So the basic process of how this works is that if a family calls or we get a referral from a school counselor or a medical social worker or anybody, and they can self-refer as well, is that we want to match up the needs of the families and the caregivers with the providers who can do that. And that's our whole focus as an information and referral network, is to match up caregivers with providers. And on the provider's end, we do background checks, we do references and orientations and trainings, you know, throughout the year to make sure that families have access to a qualified pool of providers. And there's three basic barriers why people don't access respite. First of all, they don't even know it, what it is. Secondly, they can't pronounce it. They may call it respite. They don't know what it is. But there's also, they don't have the money to pay for this. You know, at the end of the month, after you've paid your monthly bill, you're lucky if you can pay for a babysitter. And then when you get into a high level of care that's needed for respite, you know, there's no dollars. The second barrier is lack of qualified providers. And when I talked about training, that's one of the very important parts of what we do as lifespan coordinators. So the family calls in, and then we send them a packet out of information with a brochure, and we explain, we want them to explain what the levels of care are needed for that individual and their loved one. Do they want respite in their home? Do they want respite out of the home? Maybe they need to clean their house. Maybe they just want to take a nap, you know, totally undisturbed. And so we're going to try and fit their needs with the services that a provider can provide for them. And then we match it up in a database. At that point, the family does actually have some ownership in this process. They actually get to call and interview and decide who they are most comfortable with using. So we're not assigning anybody to them. They actually get to pick and choose. And there's a comfort level involved with this, and that's kind of cool because we're not just an agency that's going to assign a provider to that family. And like I said before, with the respite providers, we do the background checks, references, that kind of thing, before we even put them on a list. Now, all the providers, though, are self-employed. LifeScan is an information referral network, and we do not employ any providers. And so they are working for themselves. They set their own rate of pay. They set their own time frames of when they want to work. And there again, you know, we want to match up the two groups. That's it kind of in a nutshell. The other things that we as coordinators try to provide is caregiver trainings. We do provider trainings. We have caregiver trainings. A lot of times caregivers don't know how to take care of themselves and they get pretty stressed. So you want to teach them and empower them to take care of themselves and reduce their stress levels so they can be a better caregiver and prevent out-of-home placement for their loved ones. So we have support groups that are going on. We have training classes for caregivers and providers both. And again, it's different. All of our programs around the state come under a different fiscal umbrella, if you would. In my county, we try and offer a scholarship to help them pay for respite. It's the number one barrier for families is the cost. And so if we have fundraising, if we have donations, if we have any avenues to help families pay for respite, we absolutely need to do that and so on. Okay, and now with the recent, over the years, so I've been here for 9 years now with this program, and we have seen changes in the program since the original bill, and that is part of our concern. We've seen a decrease in the lack of technical support. It would be nice if we had some standardization in, like, a reporting mechanism or databases. We've seen a decrease in just support from the state, and we've also had some budget cuts that have really cut into just even the infrastructure of what we're doing statewide. So we have some concerns because the end result is the families are the ones that suffer. And I've had scholarships available throughout most of the 9 years of my program, and in this recent year and a half, we've lost some of that funding. And it isn't just from the state, it's also donations because it's pretty competitive out there. And it breaks my heart. It really breaks my heart to have to tell families that I helped them last year, but I can't help them this year. And these families really, really need the support. If we're only giving them $300 a year, that's not very much. That is a drop in the bucket. But it is key to their sanity and keeping the emotional welfare of this family together. Yeah. We're a national model for respite programs. And when we passed this bill in 1997, we became the first one in the entire nation. And, you know, I'd like to see that continue. I mean, we're a leader in this. We need to, my concerns are with the lack of leadership. My concerns are with the lack of leadership and the lack of funding that we've lost, that we're losing that leadership role in that model. And we need to, we not only need to maintain, but we also need to strengthen our existing program, because we're something. We've got something awesome here. And we want to continue to show that, not only just to our own state and to our own families, but nationwide. So we just really need to strengthen the program and maintain and help it grow. And the unfortunate thing is that, you know, we've seen the lack of support, but the need has not gone away. In fact, the need has actually increased. We get hundreds and hundreds of calls from all over the state, and we're actually getting calls from families outside the state. Their parents or their grandparents may still live here. They're calling from Washington and Colorado and who knows where. And so, we're not just helping families here in Oregon. We're actually helping other families, long-distance caregivers. So I'd like us to see continue to show the special thing that we've got here in Oregon. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much. That was very informative, and
thank
it kind of, certainly goes with the last topic that we've talked about, the last group. So,
okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Linda Carroll, and I'm representing Roscoe County and Hood River County's Lifespan Respite Care Program. And I come here today with two hats, as well as Leanne did. Leanne has explained the program pretty well, so I'll try not to repeat some of the things that she said, although it might be hard. I, too, have a son who has developmental disabilities, requires 24-hour family caregiving. So I do know the importance of respite. And as you know, 80% of care is done in the home by family caregivers. Our program has seen many challenges since its beginning. I've been involved with it since 1998, and one of them is the demand for respite care and for funding for services for respite care has increased. But yet, we've had a reduction in our programs. Our family support, programs have been decreased in funding for families who care for children with individuals. Children who have developmental disabilities, our new program coordinators don't have the support that we used to have from the state. We've had a reduction in technical support. A critical component of Lifespan is to make awareness of Lifespan in the state, and I'd like to see the state step forward and help us to get the word out to every county in the state about the importance of Lifespan.
Going back to your comment, 80%, what categories are you talking about?
80% of in-home care. Of families get, 80% of people with special needs, medical.
Any
type
covering.
Of special needs, 80% of that care is done in the
special
home.
Needs.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Age-related?
All ages.
Alzheimer's.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Developmental disabilities, Parkinson's, stroke, any type of care, 80% is done in-home.
Now, how much money does, I even hesitate to ask, how much money does that save the state?
I don't know about the state numbers, but nationwide it's like $306 billion a year that have been provided for in-home care.
80% of the people who need this type of care are cared for in the home at some expense, obviously.
Correct.
But the alternative would be the state stepping in and having to take care of it.
In the
institution.
Yeah, it saves the state.
Catherine, could you give
thousands
some
dollars.
Numbers?
Okay.
I mean, at some point. I mean, that's something that we will need as we continue our discussion.
Okay. Oh, and one thing I would like to make a point of, that most of the programs, the lifespan programs, are in nonprofit agencies. They house them, and they're the fiscal agent, and they sponsor the lifespan programs. And I encourage you, committee members and senator, to talk with the Ways and Means about getting additional funding support for lifespan and getting our funding back that we've lost. And I just encourage you to remember Senate Bill 648 and our family caregivers in the state of Oregon. Mr. Chair?
I would be interested in knowing what, you know, the names of the nonprofit agencies also that are involved, if we had a list of those. Senator Montesano.
How much would a family need to pay for respite care? What is...
You mean like an hourly wage, you mean?
Is there an hourly wage, or is it...
Well, it depends. I mean, there's three main factors that are going to determine what a provider would charge, let's say. The first one is probably the level of care that's needed. We have a chart that we go by, or what some of us use, and level one would be pretty basic. The person can still take care of a lot of their needs, all the way up to level three, which would be intense medical care, personal hygiene, I mean, pretty intense, tube feedings, that kind of thing. So depending on the level of care... that's going to be the main one determination factor for their charges. The second factor is how long are they doing it for? Is it just a couple of hours? Is it overnight? Is it a weekend? Is it a week? Because oftentimes providers will have what we call an hourly rate, an overnight rate, and a weekend rate. And that's going to vary, and that depends on the level of care. The third criteria is how many people they're caring for. Is it just one child? Is it an elderly couple? Is it a group home? Is it a foster care situation? Because we're providing respite for all of these entities. So the more people you care for, obviously, the cost will go up too.
But I want to know what the basic minimum would be. Is it like, I know when I tried to go through, I was providing 12 hours of care for my father, and then I thought, I was paying $18 an hour. That in 1 month was about $6,400 a month.
That's pretty high.
And so that's why I want to know what your level is.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I'll tell you what I pay an hour for care for my son. We pay $16 an hour for care for my son. Some of the respite providers on my list charge anywhere from $9-$10 an hour up to $15 an hour. This is in Wasco and Hood River counties.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committees, Penny, I just wanted to clarify that the lifespan programs are funded only very minimally at each county level to do recruiting, training, and matching of providers. Minimal funding. This entire program for the entire state is approximately $1 million a biennium. What has happened is that the programs are in various nonprofits. Generally, I think there are a couple that are run by counties. But what happens is, if it's in a AAA, they serve seniors. If it's in a DD program, they serve DD folks. Nobody's serving mental health. Virtually no one is serving at-risk and foster care families. So part of our challenge is to say, and why we introduced this bill, is the original vision was that we would have one place where people could go, and that we would combine resources and information in that one place cost-effectively. There is no money in the budget for stipends. So if you can come with money, if you are coming from an agency, for example, if you're coming from the Developmental Disabilities Program and you have some family support dollars, you can purchase life, you can purchase respite because you've got some money. Or if you're a private family, you can purchase respite care. And the programs do an incredible job of trying to generate money at the local level. It clearly is an issue that we all understand. I mean, we all understand that we, you know, parents, children, we understand the issue. But at this point, what has happened in the process over the years of sort of fragmentation is that the state agencies have started creating their own programs, respite programs. And so the whole vision of that lifespan program and pulling it together has been lost. And that is the point of this bill, is to try and pull that vision together so that we can move forward.
Okay. And I guess, in reference to my earlier question, it would be to estimate how many people give up on care and simply...
put their loved one in crisis.
Yeah, and so that's what I'm talking about, is, you know, and so obviously a lot of families will, regardless of the cost, will do that.
Right.
Mm-hmm. At great hardship, but there are those that won't do that. Mm-hmm. Or can't do that, and it's that respite that would make the difference, and that's a kind of, I don't know if that's information that is available, but I mean, there.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we will look for what we have in the way of local or statewide information on that. The lifespan bill was passed, and thanks to several other people in this room, was passed at the federal level recently. And there have been a lot of federal studies looking at the impact of respite in the child welfare system, in the aging system, in the disability system. We have incredible data on child abuse data and the involvement of respite in that. So what we can't get at the state level, we will give you federal statistics that may be relevant.
That helps put it in perspective.
Mr. Chair, just another thing we've been trying for some time, and we tried with Governor Kitzhaber to get him to make a line item in his budget for medically fragile children. Remember that?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Because what Senator Morris Anderson was talking about, if you pull them in, it runs the curve way up. Because those people need very highly skilled, very intensive care. And although it is covered here, it's really a hard thing to mesh in. And we thought it should be its own line item, didn't we?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I remember in your committee in the House, we had several medically fragile children mm-hmm. come to the hearing. And it
okay.
was interesting to right. see them.
Yeah. Yep. Thank you.
Thank you. There's another group of three that will come up. Okay. A group of two. Oh, okay. No?
Oh, you're the bad guy?
There's an empty chair there, so go ahead. So, go ahead. Introduce yourself, please.
Good afternoon. My name is Pequan Lim. I represent the respite program at Fort Lynn and Benton Counties.
Now, how do you pronounce your first name?
Pequan.
Okay.
My full first name.
I couldn't read it, so I was hoping.
That's okay. This is first time for me, too.
Okay.
We ran a respite afternoon program about 2 years ago. We lost funding since. It was for 3 hours in the afternoon once a month, a Saturday afternoon.
Now, excuse me, where are you from?
Lynn Benton.
Okay.
Right, Lifespan Respite Program
okay,
for Lynn
okay,
Benton.
Okay. I was just County. Curious. You did identify yourself properly, but I was just kind of curious about which area because we have people for
quite a few.
Thank you.
We ran a respite afternoon program for children with special needs. It was 3 hours, one afternoon, once a month,
mm-hmm.
and families would come attend the program. I would like to read a testimony from one of those families, and I was one of their respite caregiver. Her name is Catherine Skinner. She writes, "The day my son was diagnosed with autism, my mind flashed to the time 4 years earlier that a friend of ours participated in the search and rescue party searching for a little boy with autism. He had quietly left his house and never returned. That little boy was eventually found by specially trained dogs caught in an underwater drain pipe. I, of course, cried. The first time I heard of respite care, I cried again. My son was 4 years old. He had very little speech and a total inability to go to sleep. Since my husband worked from 6 a.m. to 6 p.m., it was my job to try to get him to go down and stay down. This meant sleeping in his little bed with one eye open in case he decided to wander off. Most nights he was up 5 or 6 times, walking circles in his room until 3 a.m. His father was up by 4:45 and his sister by 7 or 8 a.m. That left me with just 4 or 5 hours of sleep day after day, year after year. On his days off, my dear husband would get up with our daughter and let me sleep in. The level of vigilance required to keep a child with autism safe is intense and exhausting. This combined with both kids in diapers, autistic behaviors, the heartbreak of wondering if there will ever be a normal day made for a grinding and desperate existence. The very real dangers prevented us from just hiring the neighborhood teenager to babysit while we went to a movie, out to dinner, or out with friends to have something resembling a normal life. Special needs child care providers are virtually non-existent or exorbitantly expensive. The very idea that a program in my town, not clear up in Portland, was available to safely care for my children for a few hours so that my husband and I could recharge and relax, knowing that the kids were in a good place, concentrate on our relationship, and come back more equipped to take on the challenges of the day-to-day, left me breathless and choking on sobs. We have accessed services from Lifespan and Respite in the past on the occasion of their free respite Saturdays. These events are not regular due to funding, but they are very popular and offer aid to a fair number of families each time. We are fortunate to have family in the region who has stepped up from time to time to provide child care so that we can do a monthly grocery shopping expedition and go out to dinner on our anniversary. They have even taken the kids 2 nights since our son learned his name, address, and our names. Many families in our communities don't have family nearby, or those they do have are afraid to take responsibility for kids with special needs because it is hard, or they are fearful of hurting a medically fragile child needing feeding tubes, catheters, or home injections. My son is now 7.5, and my 5.5-year-old daughter is in the process of being evaluated for an educational diagnosis of Asperger's syndrome. I was asked today to speak to you regarding the importance and impact of respite care to parents of children with special needs. Unfortunately, the timing coincides with an extremely rare occurrence for me, time alone with my husband. It has been on the docket for a long time, so I'm unable to attend the hearing in person. I would, however, wish to impress upon you the very real value of respite care to families and society as a whole. It works more efficiently and with fewer side effects than the antidepressants and mood stabilizers many parents in the disability community end up needing. It has the potential to prevent drug, alcohol, and child abuse by alleviating extreme stress on the part of unsupported parents, especially those of young children who are still learning how to manage the special circumstances their child experiences. Just the knowledge that there is going to be some time to step off of the tightrope is a fantastic boost and helps keep the stress and anxiety from getting in the way of the love you feel for your child. I founded the Albany Autism Parents Club 3 years ago to provide a place for parents to come and get support, information, and understanding. A lot of the members hang on by the skin of their teeth all month, waiting for those 2 hours of conversation with others who know what it means to be excited for a 6-year-old who is potty training, or a 4-year-old who has doubled his vocabulary from 3 words to 6 since the last meeting. Those are the parents fortunate enough to have someone to provide child care for that time. Respite care services give families a backup team, a psychological safety net, and a tonic against marital atrophy. I ask you to please keep Lifespan Respite in one of Oregon's toolbox of disability services. Feel free to contact me if you have questions about the impact of respite on families or about the Autism Parents Club. Sincerely, Catherine Skinner. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Good afternoon. I'm Terry Urban, and I represent Tillamook County and Yamhill County Lifespan Respite. I actually live in Salem, so I don't get credit for driving that far. But since we only get less than $10,000 for the next year for Lifespan Respite, we really can't afford the gas from Tillamook, because that would be a big chunk of money out of such a small budget. I work with Catholic Community Services, and we are the fiscal agent for those two programs, and our concept is a forever home for everyone, and lifespan respite is part of the family preservation to make that happen. We believe everyone should have the opportunity to live in a loving family within a caring community, and lifespan respite helps to facilitate it, that in each of our communities. We also believe that everyone is sacred and social, so from birth to death, like we said, the poor, vulnerable, the rich, no matter what stage in life, we're all sacred and social. I did send my testimony around, which I'm not reading, along with our brochure. It has a little bit different information in it. At Catholic Community Services, we do a lot with foster care, especially for the treatment of foster parents. And one of our visions at Catholic Community Services, in conjunction with Lifespan Respite, is to provide extra respite for our foster parents. As you well know, the foster care crisis is with us right now. In Marion County, we have close to 1,500 kids in foster care. Our vision is to provide respite care to those parents one evening a week, a weekend a month, and 2 weeks out of the year. And that's all that we minimally want for ourselves when we have a job, and our jobs are limited to 40 hours usually and not 24 hours a day. Additionally, I'd just like to say I'm a part of a family team that cares for an 86-year-old and a 97-year-old that are living together. It is quite a big job. I'm lucky that I'm part of a team, and everyone, no matter where they are, deserve to have support. And I know that can really isolate people, especially if they are the one and only primary caregiver. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Jim Morrison.
Debbie, we're not going to have a public work session.
We're not going to what?
We're not going to have a work session today.
I'm here to testify.
Good.
Jim Morrison and members of the committee, I'm Debbie Bowers, and I'm the government relations liaison for the seniors and people with disabilities. I'm here to support Senate Bill 648. This is as introduced. I've noticed that there are some proposed amendments and that may have fiscal with them, and so we would have to go back and do an analysis on that. But as introduced, we support this bill because any funds would not at this time be in the governor's budget.
Yeah, I disappoint all these people. I understand there will be a fiscal on this.
There was a proposed amendment. Lifespan respite care.
The amendment wasn't written correctly.
I don't think.
The fiscal will change?
The amendment will change.
Oh, yeah, okay. No, it won't change the fiscal.
I don't know.
No. There will not be a fiscal. We will ask the president to rescind the fiscal one more time.
Ms. Chair, we're doing that on every bill.
We do that on every bill.
I am here to support Senate Bill 648.
Oh, that's why you're here.
Okay. The other people that have testified have done a very good job of telling you the importance of this program and the need to support families in Oregon. In 1997, when this program began, there was funds made available, which is true. The amount has not increased since 1997, as seed money to communities to generate activity around this issue and then try to coordinate their information and dollars and services. And it was the hope at that time that they would also contribute dollars to have these programs be more stable in their local communities. In 10 years, there's been a lot of activity around the caregiver issues across the country, and Oregon is a model for the national, the bill that was just passed and signed by the president. We support this bill. I think it's grown. The program has grown and now has different needs. And so in Section 2, it clarifies, back in the original statute, it directed the department to provide technical assistance to the local communities. And it was really a locally driven program. But now the new additions would change and clarifies actually what types of technical assistance are needed for these local programs to be successful. And we believe that this will make it be a stronger respite care network across the state. Also, the section that speaks to developing a lifespan respite council, we really support this idea because we believe that the subcommittee, there was a respite subcommittee back in 1997, and it was a subcommittee of the Family Support Council at the time. And really, it was made up of partners and the state agencies and providers and families. And this is really, I think, going to benefit the network as a whole because it'll keep that momentum and that focus on this need of respite services in Oregon. And then finally, in Section 5, it directs the department to adopt additional rules. At the time, the rules really focused more about how the dollars would be doled out to the different communities, what you had to meet, the criteria you had to meet in order to get those seed dollars. And this would expand the rules to talk more about the guidelines, the standards, performance measures, which can only build a better quality program in Oregon. And so I agree with the other people that have been testifying that if Oregon is the pioneer in any area, it really needs to go back and look and strengthen what it started. And I think that would be important for this program. And I support this bill as introduced.
Thank you very much.
It's a very good program.
I appreciate it. And we will hear this bill on Wednesday. We will have a public hearing, and then we hope to move the bill.
Mr. Chair, yes. I'd just point out that we put $1 million in this in 97.
Yeah.
It's still over $1 million. In that time, K-12 funding has increased $2 billion. Just perspective.
Some perspective. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you. And I think we're out of time, and I apologize for that. So I will close the public hearing, and we will adjourn. And thank you very much.